Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, a very happy February 5th, 2013. Thanks for joining me today. I'm the founder of Responsible Eating and Living. You can go to responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's real, R-E-A-L, and find out more about me and my nonprofit. And I'm a foodie. I think I'm a foodie. I'm pretty passionate about food. And today I've got some wonderful other foodies on the show, and I think we're going to have a really good, fun time talking about my favorite subject, food. Now, Julia Child, I need to work on that a little bit more, but that's a fun voice to imitate. Julia Child, she has influenced so many foodies in the world, in the United States, and all over. And I wanted to tell a little story about her before I introduce my first guest. You're familiar with John Robbins, my friend John Robbins. He's the son of Baskin and Robbins, Irv Robbins, who created the ice cream empire Baskin and Robbins. And he was destined to take over the ice cream empire. And then he went on his own way and he wrote this groundbreaking bestseller in 1987 called Diet for New America. And he has influenced so many of us. And we've learned so much about our food system and how food affects not only our own health, but the health of the planet and how animals are treated. He's done tremendous work. And he was speaking a lot of conferences when his Diet for a New America book came out, and he was at one with Julia Child. And when they had some time off, John tells this story about he asked her if she wanted to visit a veal barn that was near the conference that was taking place in Pennsylvania. And so she agreed, and she wasn't interested in vegetarians. She thought vegetarians were sentimental, and she just cared what food tasted like. But they did go to this veal farm, and John describes it where you could see calves chained at the neck. The chains were really short, and the animals couldn't move, and they couldn't lay down. And they would live about 3 to 4 months before they were slaughtered. Of course, they were fed a diet that was devoid of iron in order to keep their flesh white, because people considered white meat healthier and tastier. And they're advertised as being milk-fed, when actually they're not fed their mother's milk. They were fed skim milk and petroleum byproducts. Anyway, John brought Julia to this small veal farm, and it's nothing like the factory farms that we see today. But she looked around, and she simply said, "Can we go now?" And then she said, "I had no idea, no more veal." Now, this was at a time when she was pretty old, and you don't hear this story in her documentary or when people tell stories about it, but I think if we all knew more about how our food was produced, there's a lot of it that we would not tolerate. Certainly the cruelty and all the toxins and things that go into our foods, if we really knew and understood and made a noise about it, I think things would be a lot better. And that's one of the things that we do here. So that's just a little story about Julia Child. And now I want to bring on my first guest. And Julia Child had an influence somewhat on him. My guest is Mitchell Davis. He is the vice president of the James Beard Foundation, a cookbook author, a food journalist, and a scholar with a doctorate in food studies from New York University. A graduate of Cornell University School of Hotel Administration, Davis spent 2 years cooking and eating in France and Italy before settling in New York City to write about food. And we're going to learn a lot more about Mitchell Davis. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm really glad to have you here. I've been looking forward to this for months since I first met you a while back.
Indeed. And full disclosure must be that Julia Child and James Beard were very, very close friends their entire adult lives. I think they were the giants, literally and figuratively, of food in America.
Right. They both brought French cuisine to the United States.
They did. Although that was really Julia's purview. Beard brought good food. He hated the word cuisine, the word gourmet. He was famous for hating. He grew up in Portland and was a West Coast boy all his life, really, even though he made his life and career in New York City. I think that one of the differences was he loved European food, French food, Italian food, whatever, but he was American, and I think that's come to be his hallmark, really, or his legacy.
I liked reading about James Beard, knowing that before he was a foodie per se, he was trying to make it as an actor.
Yeah, in which restaurant could we go to today and not find someone just like that?
That's everybody's story in New York City. All the servers that you get, that's their story. Sure. But James Beard actually made it in the food business. Yeah. Good for him, and made it well. And then,
and actually, he's on the stage right now. There's a play about his life, a one-man show that was written last fall. It premiered in Indianapolis at the Indianapolis Repertory Theater, and has just been remounted in Portland, Oregon, his hometown.
Awesome. Yeah. Have you seen it?
I have seen it twice. Yeah.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Do you recommend it?
I do. It's a really interesting piece. The playwright is James Still, who did a tremendous amount of research, and it's Beard looking back at his life, sort of at the last few days. Well, we don't know actually if death is imminent, but he's old and reminiscing about Julia and all the sorts of things that changes that he's seen. It's interesting.
Hmm. You think it'll make it to Broadway?
You know, there's always hope.
Okay. Well, let's learn a little bit about you, how you got interested in food, and how Julia and James and
everybody. Sure.
Influenced you.
I used to tell people I was weaned on Julia Child because I came to know James Beard late in life. I think the generation before me, I started cooking from a very young age. I was born in 1968, and my family just loved to watch Julia on TV. We were already a TV family. So,
can you do a good Julia imitation?
There have been a few Halloweens when I've been known to, her and the Swedish Chef. So food has just always been an interest in my life, and I went to hotel school, as you said, and which was sort of a compromise, because at the time I wanted to be a chef from the time I was really mm-hmm. little, and it wasn't okay in some circles, you know, a middle class Jewish family. It just mm-hmm. you didn't go become a chef. I think a lot is different now. It's amazing to see, you know, when we were sitting recently, the Beard Foundation has a relationship we can talk about another time at the State Department with the State Department of the U.S. and I just none of the chefs there could believe they would ever find themselves feted by the Department of State of America for all sorts of reasons. And so things have changed like that. But I went to hotel school, which was a wonderful place, and then went to Europe, as you said, and cooked in France and in Italy, never really expecting to cook in a restaurant because I later learned it is the hardest, one of the hardest jobs there is to have. I have so much respect for chefs. I hang out
Absolutely.
With them. They're my friends. It's tough work. I think we forget when you see it on TV sometimes.
It's very romantic, and it's an art, and so many of us dream of it, but we don't dream of the sweat.
The sweat, the heat, the lifting heavy things.
The pace, the empty restaurants.
Right,
for the
danger. I mean, it's kitchen, a commercial kitchen is full of very dangerous things.
Anyway. I got my food certification. I took the test for the city certification, and it scared me just reading about it, thinking about all the things that could go wrong.
One of the most terrifying things I ever experienced myself was a sushi training hygiene course.
Ooh,
where you,
raw
yeah,
fish. Whoa.
Yeah, crazy. Yeah. I mean, you keep yourself safe of a lot of things by not eating meat or animals of any kind. But then there's still things that can happen.
Well, I mean, I love avocado maki, all the maki rolls that you get in a Japanese restaurant. But when they're using the same knife and the same cutting boards,
when the animals are being raised next door. And the chain is contaminated. I mean, there are so many things we could talk about. Anyway, but I did have an eye opening in Paris, as cliche as it sounds, about food. And it wasn't so much, I grew up eating really good food, but it was the food culture that really changed me. That people were, I don't think anyone in France would call themselves foodies, although now there's a trend called le foodisme, and that's a whole trendy thing in France. But it wasn't that they were foodies. It was just that food was as important a topic as art and literature and music and all the sorts of things. It was right up there, and it was okay to care in a way. And that's, I didn't know it then, but that's become one of the things that I spend my life doing, is getting people to care. I don't want to tell you what to eat. I mean, I think we should all eat wholesome, well-raised, environmentally sensitively produced food. But I want to empower people to actually pay attention to food, and to I think it's through that attention and discernment that we move towards better practices and better food.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I lived in the south of France for 4 years, and that was one of the things that I loved about it. Everyone cared about food. I think, unfortunately, because of American influence, some of that may be changing as much as they're trying to fight it. The younger kids are not fighting that culture.
Well, and Europe is changing. One of I've spent a lot of time in Italy since that time I lived in France, and you see the model of Europe, because of the same economies of scale and pressures or perceived pressures of production or all that sort of stuff, they're almost regressing or moving more towards what was we have in America, the system we have where everything is made in this place and shipped here, all the produce is grown in this country and shipped over there. And we're finally realizing we're at the end of that, where we're realizing actually that leads to really horrible things, and we need to go back and re-regionalize. In Europe, the sort of formation of the EU was a federalist project that, you know, strong producing countries with strong economies were making food and shipping it elsewhere. Anyway, so it's been funny. I mean, sad to see that shift, but it does feel like something's changed drastically here, where an increasingly large group of people is understanding the regionalization, the importance of re-regionalizing our food system. And that's something I have to say that James Beard, and I never knew him, but I've worked at the Beard Foundation now for 20 years. And so I know a lot about him and have spent a lot of time in his stuff, so to speak. And it was something that he always celebrated. One of his most famous books was American Cookery, which came out in 1972. It's a giant, thick book, which at the time I think was rare. Now all cookbooks seem to be these giant tomes. There's one right in front of us. But it was a celebration of the differences of American things, not all the sameness of American things. There are lots of recipes for beans, let's say, and they're different from town to town and region to region, and he has them all. He didn't just want to find the one bean dish. So there's something really resonant today, I think, with some of the groundwork that he laid in his life. He wrote from 39 till he died in 1985. He was constantly producing stuff. I do think he had a lot of the values that have come to be embraced by the food movement before anyone realized there was something different going on.
Yeah, I really am bothered by all the sameness that goes around in the United States, and starting to see it in other countries, too. You know, on our street in Forest Hills, a Chipotle just moved in. You know, we have a lot of these small little mom-and-pop stuff, and I love it because it brings all kinds of culture and interest and variety.
Totally.
Oh,
you forget, I mean,
quality.
Not just in food. I know this is a food show, but, you know, in office products, you know, everyone has the same trash can, and that drives me crazy. Like, why can't there be different ones? It all has to be the $2 trash can from Staples. Like, that, I mean, it's part of the challenge, I think, because, you know, we're so obsessed with the economics of anything that economies of scale are so appealing for certain groups of people, and they lead to all of this sort of sameness. And food, I think, is the most is the realm in which the effects of that are most detrimental. I mean, obviously, it doesn't really matter what your garbage can looks like. You're putting garbage in it, although it would be nice. When you go to Europe, you see, oh, wait, there's different doorknobs. Every doorknob doesn't come from the same place.
They're all from IKEA.
Yeah. Well, okay. But in food too, food is the place where I always say food is not widgets. You actually, whether or not you believe in the business model of other industries, when they're trying to apply to food, what you get is the crap that we're all fighting against. It isn't just an aesthetic fight. It's about our health and the planet and the environment.
I was thinking when you were talking about doorknobs, it wasn't doorknobs. It was toilet flush mechanisms that were so varied in Europe.
Right. And you never, so varied that you don't even know what to push or
where
to look.
Where
right.
They were.
From
it's
the
like,
ceiling.
Holy
right.
Crap.
Right.
What do I do now?
But no. we take that for granted. I mean, I have to say, it's so funny because even in America, I was born in the New York area. I was born in New Jersey and I grew up in Toronto. And in Canada, they put light switches in different places. So my whole life, I learned where to look for a light switch. And you come here, it's usually outside the room. Mm-hmm. And here, it's always inside the room. And these are small things you take for granted. There are cultural differences. And food is the biggest area where that is true.
I want to get back to France just for a minute. Have you heard the story about the vegan who walked into Chez Bocuse?
No, but was there a rabbi and an Irishman involved or no?
No. So when I lived in France, I was living with a Frenchman, and we were first living in Lyon, the cuisine capital
nice,
of France
sure.
and the world. And he wanted to celebrate my birthday at the best restaurant that he knew of, and that was Paul Bocuse's restaurant, Chez Bocuse. And he called them 2 weeks before my birthday to say, look, I've got this vegan with me. Now, this was the early 90s.
Okay.
And he explained what I ate, what I didn't eat. And they said, you know, sure, no problem. Aucun problème, venez, and come on in. And 2 days before we were coming in, He sent them a fax to remind them of what the situation was. We showed up at the restaurant, and no one had a clue who we were. And
so
every
French.
Course was a disaster. I had to have the same conversation. It had to go back. And there was, I think there was only one other filled table. It was a weeknight. It wasn't busy. And yet I got the worst awful scowls. Now, I have to say that in the 4 years I lived there, I never had a bad experience except that one time. Most chefs were very welcoming, and they said, I accept the challenge, and I was always satisfied and got some really beautiful dishes.
Interesting. Bocuse was the first assignment I was ever given in the food world as a professional food writer. I was working at a magazine called Art Culinaire, and the first person I had to go interview was Paul Bocuse. It's a little intimidating, although I'm surprised at that level, at a Michelin three-star level, they wouldn't have found that fact somewhere or done something for you. But they couldn't do something. Yeah, right. Anyway, I wonder how much that's changed in those years. I have a feeling it might still be not difficult. As you said, it was an easy time, but there's a cultural component to it also, and that we talk about a lot amongst my colleagues. And there are, in different food cultures, there are ways that diners are in restaurants. Like the relationship between the restaurant and the diner is different. And in America, of course, it's always about the customer's always right.
I wanted to bring this up, and you're bringing it up.
Funny.
So perfect.
Yeah, so the customer's always right, and the customer has needs, and the servers, quote-unquote, are there to serve those needs. And that is not how it is in a lot of places. And I think of Japan even more than France, where there are so many rules, and they're a food-obsessed culture, but often people consider them rude, but I feel like you are operating so outside what they understand behavior to be that they don't even know how to react or how to help in some cases. And although we think of the French, actually no one really thinks of them as being just like us, but it's, but there are these things that we take for granted. And I think they're very...
The ugly American.
Yeah. Well, ugly, but also open in so many ways, unbound by all of these other rules and traditions. I think that's partly why our food right now is so exciting and there's so much going on here, because the rules sometimes only let you go so far.
Well, the thing about chefs and French chefs is they feel like what they're doing is an art, and they are offering their art to you, and you don't change what they're offering. But today, in a world where people have food allergies and religious issues, and then there are people, crazy vegans with ethical issues, is there a balance? I think it was around 2002, I forget when it was, but I had never met another vegetarian when I lived in France. And then in the early 2000s, they had the first Veggie Pride Parade.
Oh, hysterical.
And I love that they called it Veggie Pride,
right,
because they were literally coming out of the closet.
Right.
Because they were hiding.
Right, right. Well, I once asked a famous feminist scholar, why was all this amazing work going on among French women feminists at around the same time? It seemed so funny in such a sexist place. And it was like, duh. She's like, where else would the reaction be? Where else would you need to assert veggie pride except in a place where meat prevailed? In some ways, you'd have to rally. But from that can come amazing change. I mean, as we see in other social issues.
Okay, let's talk about the James Beard Foundation.
Sure.
And how did that come about, and what did they do, and what do you do there?
Well, Beard died in 1985, and the foundation was born posthumously. He had nothing to do with it, theoretically, except that there was this home where he lived in Greenwich Village on West 12th Street. And in that home, so many people had such warm and important associations with it, because he was really this the ultimate host. He invited, in fact, Julia Child is a great story, when her book was about to come out, she came to New York. Her publishers brought her and her co-authors, and they asked her who she wanted to meet, and she said there was only one person. It was James Beard. And so he threw a big party. And the idea that he threw a big party to introduce people to each other, to celebrate food that he taught in his home, so many people had come through there. So students and colleagues and friends of his thought it was a bit of a shame that this home would not live on, let's say. And it had been on the market for some time, and they just raised the money to buy it without really knowing what the foundation would become. And in 1986, when there was enough money to purchase the home, Peter Kump, who had a cooking school in New York and was a student and friend of Beard's, bought the home, and to just raise some money, everything had been auctioned off. It was an empty shell, except for Beard's longtime companion, Gino Cofaci, had a lifetime lease on a floor with Beard's dog, his pug, Percy, and there was another tenant on the fourth floor. So the two floors were empty. Peter organized a dinner to raise some money to buy some stuff for the house, and Barbara Kafka was very important in that. She wrote a book and gave the money to the foundation to also buy some stuff. And Wolfgang Puck was this young, hot start Californian chef. And he cooked a dinner, and I think 14 or 16 people came, and everyone thought this was great. And they started to hold dinners. That's how we evolved from that idea. And it was kind of radical. It's funny now that every restaurant has a tasting menu, like vegan restaurant, any restaurant has a tasting menu. But at the time, the idea that there would be a place you'd go for dinner, there'd be a set menu, you would sort of see a chef perform, was kind of radical here. And it just grew through word of mouth. We've always been a 501c3 nonprofit, so we are a public company. For a long time, we used to fight against this idea that it was a private dining club, except that everything we always did was always open to everybody. Excuse me. Of course, everybody with the means to have dinner, which is a whole other topic we can talk about. But increasingly now we have over 200 dinners a year with different chefs every single time from somewhere in the world. So we become this performance-based. Julia Child actually called us the Carnegie Hall for Chefs. And then in 1991, we started something that really catapulted us into the national and international stage, and that was the James Beard Awards for chefs, and later books and food journalists and restaurants and radio broadcasters and all kinds of stuff. And those awards were the first sort of coveted merit-based recognition for chefs. There were other trade organizations and awards like that, but it was the first time that the consumers learned about them. I mean, it's funny because today, every time I turn on the TV, whether it's Letterman or Top Chef, they're always saying the James Beard Award-winning or James Beard nominated, but at the time it was crazy. There was nothing. That was almost 25 years ago that those awards started, and they've really grown to be the most coveted thing of what we do. A couple of other things we do and have always done alongside them. Part of our nonprofit status is because we raise a lot of money for scholarships and tuition waivers for people who want to pursue a career in the culinary arts, we say. Almost $4.5 million since we started that in 1991 we've given away or awarded. And then just in the last 5 years, sort of as all the world of food has changed and chefs' interests have changed and people who consume food with a passion of foodies, let's say, has changed, we've started to get into some of the issues that everyone is waking up to about how the food is produced. And we started an annual conference called it's called the James Beard Annual Food Conference. It's very creative, but it's about sustainability and public health. And we bring thought leaders and the whole idea together. And the whole idea is to bring as many diverse perspectives and opinions into the room and to try to not so much change, it is to change what people think, but it's really to change what people believe, to change their values. I mean, we feel like it's funny, chefs at the highest levels are working with the finest products in the truest sense, you know, small produced, locally produced. It's sort of where that movement began. And I think America's unique that way. You saw that in the south of France. Mm. No, that was just what you took for granted is that things came from around here. In America, it's come the other way, top down from the chefs on down. But not, you know, when you have the CEO of a giant global food corporation sitting next to a farmer or a chef, we hope we can make some value shifts that will move everyone a little bit farther. We don't have our own political agenda per se, although some of us keep it deep inside and hope it oozes out all over the room. But really, we want the people that we bring there to move everything more where we want it to go. So we've been doing more and more work like that. And it's been very rewarding, both because of the connections and the value sharing that we've seen, but also just to empower chefs, as I said, to really take the front line of food folks and put them in these positions to change some of these other people who are so removed from the act of producing and eating food because of the nature of business.
Well, I think that food should obviously taste good, look beautiful, but it can also be good for us. And I think all of that is very possible and should be part of the equation for anyone putting together a dish. And gentle on the environment.
Absolutely. I agree. And I'll add, just because I've come from a great couple of panels about the workers who actually produce the food, and if we're talking about ethical eating, we really want to... We really want to make sure that it's that the ethics are shared for all of the people and plants and things that touch that food. I think it's really important.
You have something called the Enlightened Eaters series, and I know my friend Linda Long, she was on this show recently with her newly published Virgin Vegan. She'll be talking on March 6th at noon at the Beard House. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little more about the Enlightened? I like that.
Yeah,
I like
sure,
to think I'm
you.
An Enlightened
yeah,
Eater.
Yeah, and I think everyone needs to aspire to be an Enlightened Eater. We spend so much time trying to ignore the connections of things. Enlightened Eaters, they're free conversations. They happen a couple of times a month. They're always at noon. We have they're in line with another series called Beard on Books, where other authors come in. But Enlightened Eaters, obviously, are authors and chefs and sometimes dietitians or people coming in to talk about these very issues about the wholesomeness of our food in some important ways. Linda Long is a great example. He'll be talking about her new vegan book.
She also authored Great Chefs Cook Vegan, and I love that book, too, just because I think all restaurants should accommodate all eaters.
For sure. And it's one of the things we like to do at the Beard House, where we've had a few vegan meals, although quite honestly, not as many as I want to be able to tell you we've had, but more than it's an increasing number, because we really want, to us, the most educational public service of the house, the Beard House, would be to allow chefs to do things in there that they couldn't normally do for whatever reason they think elsewhere. So whether it's explore an ingredient, we have this amazing tomato event every year where every course from soup to nuts is tomatoes. And also we once famously asked David Chang, a chef famous for his aggression in some ways towards vegetarians, to cook a 12-course vegetarian menu for us, because we want to challenge people to think about things differently. And it's nice to be able to do that when we can.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. And I'm glad that you're having this Enlightened Eater series. So if anyone's interested in it, they can go to
jamesbeard.org. And all of these things are on the calendar.
And the James Beard House is located at 167 West 12th Street between 6th and 7th Avenues here in Manhattan.
Excellent. You can also follow us on Twitter, is where you get the most up-to-date information. At Beard Foundation is our Twitter handle.
Right. We just have maybe a couple minutes left. And you know, you mentioned, you didn't use this word, but I'm going to use the word privilege. You know, we both have a great privilege to be able to choose our food and talk about our food. And the James Beard House promotes a lot of chefs that many of us can't
Sure.
even afford to go to. How does that fit into the equation?
I mean, it's a good question. And increasingly, I actually did a TEDx talk about the idea that I think we need to change the notion, and one of the things that's been limiting us, an obstacle for some big food system change, is that this perception that local food, organically raised food, all these sorts of things are only for people with means. And that I think if we could shift the mindset, the value system of the folks in charge of big food companies to think that should be the de facto stance. That's the right, that it isn't just a luxury to choose food that's ethically raised or environmentally sensitively raised, but that ought to be the standard. And you see that in other countries around the world, that then the separation, I think the persistence of the separation, although very real because of how we set up our business model, helps to keep, I mean, for lack of a better word, rich people, giving them the options to eat better, and we just think that poor people ought to be happy for what they got. And I don't believe that at all. And I think that some of the work that we need to do is to change that everyone has a right to be discerning about their food and to have wholesome food raised well. If you set the playing field levelly, then no one can keep them apart.
Yeah, we all are entitled to clean air, clean water, wholesome, nutritious food, a roof over our heads.
Yeah.
And these should just be basic rights.
Yeah, I would add healthcare in there
because absolutely.
I come from Canada and I can't believe some of the things you hear here.
Yeah.
That, anyway.
Well, thank you, Mitch, for joining me. And it's all about food.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And we're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back for the second part of our show. I'm going to be talking with Annie and Dan Shannon. They've got a great new cookbook out called Betty Goes Vegan. We'll be right back. Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Here we are on the 5th of February, 2013. Thank you for joining me. And I want to bring on my next guests. This is going to be so much fun. Annie and Dan Shannon live in Brooklyn, New York. Annie has worked at the Animal Advocacy Organization in Defense of Animals and as the Fashion Industry Liaison for the Humane Society of the United States. She does most of the cooking. Dan was previously the director of youth outreach and campaigns for PETA and is now senior strategist for the social movement strategy consulting company Purpose. He does the dishes. Please welcome to It's All About Food, Annie and Dan Shannon. Hello.
Hi.
How are you today? Yeah, well, you guys are so amazing. Now, I just want to start the show off by talking about yesterday's Today Show. Congratulations.
Oh,
that was really fun to watch, but I want to say that the 3 minutes and 26 seconds were not enough.
No,
you deserved a lot more. And what I don't understand is why those two women host that show and why people watch it, because they did not seem to be the brightest lights in the room.
I have to admit, Hoda was really nice. Go ahead.
Yeah, they're probably nice, but I don't know. I don't get those women. So first I want to remind people that we pronounce the term for people who don't eat any animal foods and abstain from all products. We call ourselves vegan. Vegan, vegan, it's not vegan, it's vegan. Maybe in other languages.
Vegan is someone from Las Vegas, you know.
That's right. No, we are vegan, we're the aliens from the planet Vega. Or maybe that's what the vegans are. Okay, anyway, you have just come out with an amazing cookbook, Betty Goes Vegan. And I'm so glad Betty is going vegan. I'm so glad. Because she represents so much of what America is all about. And if Betty is going vegan, well, then it won't take long for everybody else to follow along, will it?
No, you know, I have to admit, when we first started doing this, you know, the goal was really, we wanted to take on a project where we could use, like, vegan products and show how to help them reach their full potential. And Betty Crocker has such a, like, long-standing, like, great reputation for showing, like, you know, American chefs how to do that with, like, stuff like Bisquick and things like that. But it seems like such a natural fit. But it's been great, though, because the Betty Crocker company has actually been really supportive. So, you know, it's been pretty great, actually, to see that happen.
You probably didn't hear at the beginning of the show when I introduced my other guest. I told a little story about John Robbins and Julia Child. I'm not sure if you know that story, but he brought her to a veal farm, and after she saw what was going on, she said, no more veal. Now, this is when she was quite old, and you don't hear about this much in mainstream media, but Julia Child had a tremendous influence on so many of us. And I know, I know reading from your blogs that the movie Julia and Julia influenced you to start this Betty Crocker project.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because it's like, you know, I went into it, I was actually really excited about the movie. I was kind of like, whoa, this is a movie with a heroine that I could definitely relate to. And, you know, then I got to the scene where she had this sort of moral dilemma about boiled lobsters, and you know she did it. And tell them what the movie set up, that we were like applaud her bravery for overcoming her fear of boiling lobsters alive. And we just—I did not leave that movie the same.
Annie, you know, I don't know if if you could move to another place, but it's breaking up a little bit. So,
oh, no. Okay.
Yeah, we want to hear everything that you have to say.
Oh, no. Can you hear me better now?
Yeah, much better.
Okay, good.
I think when the when the Julia and Julia project came out, a lot of us thought, oh my God, we need to have something like that that's vegan. And I enjoyed reading at the beginning of your cookbook that you dedicated it to the lobsters, because I know many of us had that same reaction in watching that movie, seeing all these wonderful recipes and then watching her boil the lobster.
It was really a sort of a negative.
I feel like, yeah, like Annie was saying, it's very discouraging to see almost like the message that you should be encouraged to overcome your conscience. You know, I think part of why we want to direct this book and work on this project is to encourage more people to think more about their conscience when they're making food choices, you know, whether it's, you know, choosing vegan food or even just choosing locally grown food, organic produce or whatever. Like, we should be thinking more critically about the food that we eat, and we should be listening to that voice in our head that says, you know, hey, maybe this isn't okay, maybe this isn't something I should be a part of. And so, you know, I think that was part of what inspired us and inspired Annie, really, to undertake this project.
Well, what I said a little earlier in the first part of the show is I absolutely believe and know that food can be not only delicious, good for you, and good and gentle on the planet, but 100% vegan. There's absolutely no reason why all the food we eat can't be made from plants, and I know everyone can be satisfied with them. It's just, we just need the time to show people and put really good food in their mouths.
Yeah, I mean, we agree, you know. It's just that Dan and I kind of live this life with this motto of, you know, anything can be vegan, you know, like, give us something and we can make a vegan version. And that was kind of, you know, what we really hope this book proves.
When I was reading a little bit about you and how you were picking out what cookbook to ultimately veganize, and you had thought about the joy of cooking, I had a very similar experience. When I was a teenager, I had gotten a Joy of Cooking cookbook, and I carried it with me all over the place until the cover was gone and it was in shreds. And what I was doing basically with it was veganizing everything I found in it. And then it disappeared, and I don't know what happened to it, and I'm sorry it's gone, but, we don't need that anymore. Anyway, I don't need it anymore. Now we have Betty Goes Vegan.
The thing about the Joy of Cooking book was that, you know, it's a great book, but it's like, you know, it's like a Bible. And one of the things, we were like reading through it, and it would just have like pages and pages and pages on like how to cut your pork.
Yeah.
You know, and so we went with Betty instead because it seemed like it could translate a little bit better on like what it is we actually wanted to do. So.
Well, the Joy of Cooking had every recipe in it. Everything was in there. Yeah,
that's true. Huh.
Okay, let's talk about your beautiful book. Number one, it's big. 500 classic recipes. There's everything in here. It's really, really amazing. So the first recipe you have in here, fried eggs. Now, I have to say, this is genius. Really genius.
Thanks.
Can you talk about your fried egg recipe?
Yeah, like pretty much, you know, the Bake Cracker book, there's a lot of recipes that, you know, require like a fried egg or a poached egg or something. So it was going to be one of the biggest challenges, you know, like Dan and I made these jokes about how it was like kind of be our like Moby Dick, you know, what I mean? It was going to be the thing that was going to take us down. And, you know, we figured out how to use this thing called a flavor injector. You know, it's like this crazy big syringe thing that, like, Paula Deen uses to inject, like, sauces into meat, you know. And we kind of reappropriated this barbecue tool to inject, like, a nutritionally yeast sort of cheesy sauce into a piece of tofu to make, like, that liquid center that you would find in, like, a fried egg.
It's I was really smiling when I saw it, because so many of us, I've been vegan for 25 years, and I've made many, 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 many tofu scrambles. They're really easy, and some of them are more sophisticated than others, and a lot of non-vegans will happily eat it, and some of them will even be fooled. And then I had made a hard-boiled egg recipe a few years ago, and it's not the same as your hard-boiled egg recipe. I ended up blending silken tofu with a little agar and remolding it like an egg shape. But so much fun to serve deviled eggs that really look like deviled eggs and have all of these people's eyes pop out like, whoa, that's not an egg.
Well, that's the whole idea. It's like the proof of concept of what Annie was saying, that like you can make, you know, there's literally a vegan version of anything that you can imagine. And I think once you sort of can show people that, you know, that you can't stump us, like there's nothing you can come up with that we can't find a way to do it, again, opens their eyes to the fact that like a vegan lifestyle really is like a sustainable choice for anybody. Anybody can be satisfied on it, as you were saying earlier. Anybody can be excited about the food. There's always going to be new foods to try. You know, you're certainly not just going to be eating, you know, quinoa and lentils for the rest of your life. And don't get me wrong, I love quinoa and lentils, but we eat that a lot. But there's all kinds of other food out there. So I think that's part of what we were trying to do, is to show absolutely anything. This is how you can do it. So there's really no argument. You know, there's no case to be made that you can't eat happily and healthily on a vegan diet.
Okay, let's talk about meat. Now, there are so many meat analogs out there today, and you promote a lot of them, and this certainly makes things a lot easier for so many people. Now, I have to say a disclaimer. Some of these are not the healthiest foods on the planet, but for those that are moving from meat, they're definitely a fabulous alternative. For those people that are having a craving and just have to have their meat fix, some of these are really amazing and will really satisfy you. So I think they're really wonderful, wonderful products.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things, too, that there's some people out there that it's about convenience, you know. They grew up learning how to cook by, you know, I just fry up my, you know, ground meat, or my hamburger, and then, I use hamburger helper, and then that's dinner, you know. And so for a lot of these, like, mock meats, you know, they give you the convenience oftentimes that you would find using actual, like, animal meat. You know, it's one of those things where it takes a lot of the do-it-yourself elements out. And so if you're not someone who's really, like, even excited about cooking, you can still be vegan and like make really great things at home with just as convenient as if you're, you know, using, you know, dairy cheeses and whatever. And so that's one of the things that we really like about it, is that, like, you know, you don't have to be a foodie in order to be vegan, you know?
Yep.
And that's, you know, and the other thing is too, is that, you know, mock meats have come so far, you know, that, like, a lot of times what we had, like, you know, when Dan and I first went vegan back in, like, the 80s, you know, the things that we had for mock meat, like, were not great.
No, like, they were pretty not great. Yep.
Oh, they were terrible. And, like, Dan and I joke about this all the time, about how, like, they've come so far, and, like, you're able to do so much more with them, with, like, these new products, that we really wanted to, like, try to reintroduce these things to some people who maybe have written off mock meat in the past, you know. And it's because we really want people to enjoy being vegan, you know. And it's just like, if one of the things that's taking away from your enjoyment of being vegan is that you really miss like beef stroganoff, well, we have a beefless stroganoff, you know. And so we're hoping that makes a difference.
You know, it's 2013 and we're talking about enlightened eating, and we really want to encourage people to move away from all the food that is related to cruelty, pain, and suffering, and damage to the environment. But, you know, some of these foods that all of us happening vegans are eating were created thousands of years ago, some of them, by Asians and Buddhist monks. And we have this wonderful store in New York, Mewa, and you mentioned some of their products in your book. But some of their products come from Taiwan, and they've been made they use these ancient recipes to make some of these mock meats that are so close to meat, it's scary, but really, really tasty.
It's funny you mentioned Mewa. I'm actually literally about 100 feet from the Mewa store right now. My office happens to be around the corner from there. But you're right. You know, a lot of times, you know, when people will talk about veganism or talk about meat replacements, they'll, you know, think about it as sort of being this kind of like a fad diet, or this is something sort of new. But like you said, this is a philosophy, for lack of a better word, that's been around for, you know, for many thousands of years. You talked about, you know, ancient, you know, China and India, you know, Buddhist cultures, even in ancient Greece, there were vegans. And so, you know, it's not necessarily, some sort of a new agey whatever thing that some people may try to paint it as. And again, I think that's part of what we're trying to show is that it's a compatible philosophy and a compatible lifestyle with people who think about sort of maybe traditional, you know, more traditional values or think, oh, I don't want to be necessarily a part of the latest trend or fad. You know, that isn't what this is. It's more of a, I like the term you use, it's an enlightened way of thinking about eating and thinking about food.
There are a couple of recipes for chicken wings in your book, and of course you need the chicken wing that you can get at Mewa and some other places, but I remember the first time I had one of these things, it was indescribable. And these things are so delicious, and we can be so creative as you've been. You've got the cherry cola vegan chicken wings and the spicy Thai vegan chicken wings. Delicious.
If you have a chance to make those spicy Thai wings, I definitely recommend those ones. Those are one of my favorite recipes in there.
And then, of course, the comfort foods. And, you know, you talked about this in your book, how vegans are really crazy about food. We love food. We're so passionate about food. We want it to taste great. We're not, I mean, there might be a small handful that are not interested in food and are happy with steamed vegetables and brown rice. And I'm happy with steamed vegetables and brown rice from time to time. But I love the variety. And sometimes comfort foods are so important. And I'm looking at your mini pot roast pies, bringing back my memory of the Swanson pot pie that I grew up with.
You know, and it's funny because those are actually, they're so easy to make, you know, and it's one of those things, like, if you can toss something in a bowl and, like, you know, use a cookie cutter, then you can make your own pot pies, you know, I mean, they're so easy, and they're, like, they use puff pastry and, like, things that, like, really aren't, like, they aren't really ingredients that people, like, have never heard of before, you know, like, it's not that foreign, so it's just, we're hoping that we're, you know, it kind of shows that maybe if you just use them a little differently, you know.
So we have to be.
I just want to take this opportunity to say that the pot pie is my personal favorite recipe in the entire cookbook. So if anyone is wondering where to start, that's my strong recommendation.
Absolutely. Okay. We'll make that tonight. Let's just talk about some of the products that you use in your recipes that make vegan cooking so accessible and easy. So we talked about the faux meats, but there are so many other products that are out there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know. Let's see. Like, there's we really love Bragg's liquid amino acids. You know, like, that's something. When we were veganizing the recipes, we really tried to use Bragg's when we could to replace the salt in recipes. So, like, you could still get that savory flavor or, like, a beefy flavor with, like, a little less sodium. You know, and just make it a tiny bit healthier. You know, it's not really a health cookbook, but we try to do that.
There's plenty of sodium in that product, but it does give up. It has a meaty flavor, and I guess that's the amino acids that they put in there. But it has that, I don't know, that sweaty, meaty flavor.
I like to think of it as beefy.
Juicy, so, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a really great product. It's been around for a long time.
Yeah, and it's a product too that I think a lot of people, like, they use it instead of soy sauce, and they may not have thought of oh, hey, I could cook my veggie burger in that and maybe make my veggie burger a little bit juicier or something. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty great product that I think maybe isn't always used to its full potential.
Another one that I like are the vegan mayonnaise products, and you mentioned vegan. I always say it wrong, so it's Veganaise. I'm all about pronunciation. Veganaise. I always want to call it Veganaise, but it's Veganaise.
Well, you know what's funny about that is that I'm the kind of, before I went vegan a long time ago, I never enjoyed mayonnaise. I always thought it was disgusting. I still think it's disgusting. But Veganaise, and you're right, the appropriate pronunciation. I love it. I think it's delicious.
Better than mayonnaise.
What's that?
It's better than mayonnaise.
It's way better, and I feel like it, and I know other people, friends of mine who aren't vegans, who also don't enjoy mayonnaise, because it's one of those things a lot of people have strong opinions about, but do enjoy Veganaise, and they'll actually use that, because you're right, it's better, it's tastier. It doesn't have that kind of weird, slimy, I don't know, pitchiness that mayonnaise has, that I never enjoyed.
And no added E. coli or salmonella poisoning.
Yeah, that's always a nice touch, too.
And I appreciate you mentioning Earth Balance and talking a little bit about palm oil in your introduction. You know, I think people, whenever they can, look for opportunities to point the finger at vegans for doing something bad. And they can do it with products that have palm oil. And then they can do it with quinoa. You know, I'm very sad to hear that the people in Bolivia, where quinoa is grown, are eating less quinoa because America is eating more of it, and there's that issue. But, and so many point the finger, it's the vegans' fault. But, you know, there's so many things wrong with our food system. And yeah. I think we're helping, we're not hurting.
I think that's
definitely
right. I mean, I think, yeah, listen, I mean, in any sort of, I mean, you can look at any, you know, product that's created through any kind of industrialized system, and you're going to be able to find some kind of an ethical concern with it. And that's valid. And we should look for any opportunity that we can to kind of reduce the impact that our consumer choices are making, are having in a negative way. But I think when you look holistically at, you know, all the different vegan foods versus all the different meat and animal-based foods, there's no question that moving from, you know, animal-based food production, factory farming specifically, to vegan foods and a plant-based diet has a hugely overwhelmingly net positive impact on the world, even if, yes, there are things like palm oil or like the quinoa situation that you talked about, which I agree is terrible, even if there are certain sort of negative outcomes there. You know, Annie talks a lot about the idea that you do the best you can as a consumer and as an ethical consumer. You know, you make the best choices you can when you can. None of us are going to be perfect all the time. That doesn't mean we shouldn't strive to make the best choices that we can. And that's bigger, I think, at times than just being vegan. You know, certainly we're vegan 100% of the time, but it's also about things like fair trade. It's about buying organic produce when you can. It's about, you know, going to your local farmers market and supporting local agriculture as opposed to big corporate agribusinesses. You know, there's more than just, you know, sort of switching from hamburgers to veggie burgers. You know, we encourage everybody to, and we hope our book will encourage people to begin exploring all of those different options for reducing the impact that their diet has on the planet around us.
So let's talk about Earth Balance. And what I liked about what you mentioned about Earth Balance is that they're aware of the problem with palm oil and rainforest destruction, and they're doing things to make sure that that palm oil ultimately isn't destructive on the planet and to indigenous cultures. And I think we should be working together. They know what we want, and we know what is necessary, and we should support them and work together on that. I'm just really glad that you mentioned that in your book.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where I think, you know, with really good intentions, a lot of people will, like, read a product and see that it has palm oil in it, and they'll just be like, okay, I need to boycott that.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is it's not quite as black and white as that, because, you know, like, people like Earth Balance, like, they're really making they're putting a financial investment in getting ethically sourced palm oil. Like, you know, they could go for even the cheaper stuff, and they're paying more to, like, work with these co-ops and, like, you know, find places where orangutans don't live, and, like, I mean, they're really putting an effort into it. And so, you know, I think the thing is that, you know, every time we spend our dollar, we're casting a vote, and we should really be working towards, like, promoting this sort of attitude and, like, respect, you know, what they're doing, and because that's how we're going to encourage other companies to do the same.
Well, what I love about it is we can have really wonderful, tasty, delicious, beautiful food, and you've got 500 recipes showing us how to do that. But Dan, I have one question for you before we go, and I want to know what kind of dishwashing liquid you use when you wash those dishes.
So this is a great question. We have a couple of different tools in our arsenal. We like the seventh generation. Is actually really good. We also use the Method detergent sometimes. You know, any kind of, we get different scents to kind of make sure that our kitchen smells nice. But yeah, man, I got some serious dishpan hands that I've been working on over the past couple of years. But I got to say, both of those products are really good. They're really, like, they don't have a lot of harsh chemicals, you know, which is part of why we like them.
And no animal products. No animal products.
Exactly right. And not testing on animals either. Method, as a company, doesn't test any of their products on animals, which we obviously really like a lot as well.
Right. So not only do we want to eat plant foods, but we want to use as many products as possible that don't contain pain and suffering in them. For animals or for human animals, too. But that's a whole nother subject. Okay, Annie and Dan, best of luck with you, and best of luck to Betty going vegan. And thanks for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Join me at responsibleeatingandliving.com for more delicious recipes. And next week, Dr. Joel Fuhrman, he will show us how the end of diabetes has arrived. Join me next week. And have a delicious week.